Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by none other than the Dollar Shave Club. Do you have hair on your face or other parts of your body that you like to remove on a periodic basis using the most effective and luxurious products available without the hassle of going out to the shops to buy expensive shaving gear, which you always forget to do anyway, so you end up resorting to a rusty razor that renders a regrettable red rash? Well, you need Dollar Shave Club. I love these guys. I get genuinely excited when their boxes arrive in the mail. Here's how it works. You sign up for their starter set, which includes a weighty executive handle, 4 6-blade cartridges, and a tube of their shave butter. But the blades, by the way, are the best I've ever used. It's like shaving with a lightsaber, except without all the stress of using the force. Now, then you tell Dollar Shave Club how often you want regular shipments, whether that's every month or 3 times a year. There are no long-term commitments, and you can cancel your membership at any time. For a limited time, listeners of this podcast who join Dollar Shave Club will get the starter set for just $15 and $10 off your second order. To get your starter set for just $15 and $10 off your second order, go to dollarshaveclub.com/swagman. That's dollarshaveclub.com/swagman. This episode is also brought to you by Goodwill Wine, our newest sponsor and one for the Australian listeners in particular. CEO and founder Dave is a listener of the podcast, and I originally got in touch with Dave when his angel investor reached out to me, who also listens to the podcast, and sent me a box of their lovely wine. I love the Goodwill Wine story. Just over 10 years ago, Dave lost everything he owned in the Black Saturday bushfires. But thanks to donations from around the country, he was able to rebuild. And with $15,000, he built Goodwill Wine. Goodwill Wine produces awesome Australian wines, and they give back 50% of the profits to a charity of your choosing. So far, they've given $350,000 and counting. Half of their team are long-term unemployed or living with a disability. Also, the wine's not shit. I've tried it. It's not shit. So head to goodwillwine.com.au and buy the mixed red case. If you then enter my exclusive voucher code SWAGMAN, you'll get free shipping and an upgrade on the Pinot Noir. So if you're an Aussie and you like red wine, go to goodwillwine.com.au, select the mixed red case, and enter the discount code SWAGMAN. The show is also sponsored by Blinkist. Blinkist is an app that condenses the best nonfiction books in the world into 15-minute blinks, which you can read or listen to. Now, I enjoy reading, but I don't think Blinkist should be a substitute for reading, so here's how I use it. I use it as a complement to reading, much like Amazon's Look Inside or Kindle Sample feature, which help you dip your toes into a book and see whether it's the one for you. Blinkist does that, but even better, by summarizing the entire thesis of the book and delivering it to you in a 15-minute summary. That basically means you can triage whether this is a book you want to read, whether this is a book you don't want to read. That is important, ladies and gentlemen, because the cost of reading is not in the money spent on the book. It's more importantly in the time spent reading it, time which could be spent on other things like reading better books or shaving or drinking Goodwill wines. So, what you need to do is get on Blinkist by going to my exclusive landing page, blinkist.com/swagman, where you can get 25% off an annual subscription and you get to try Blinkist Premium free for 7 days. Don't be a dummy. Go to blinkist.com/swagman, where you can get 25% off an annual subscription and try Blinkist Premium free for 7 days. That's blinkist.com/swagman.
You're listening to the Jolly Swagman podcast. Here's your host, Joe Walker.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, swagmen and swagettes, welcome back to the show. For many countries across the Anglosphere, high house prices have become a fact of life. They've also become a source of irritation, inequality, and intergenerational enmity. The most pervasive narrative, propagated by pundits, property spruikers, policymakers, and prime ministers alike, is that house prices are principally driven by housing supply. And a shortage of it, whether due to NIMBYism or geographic constraints, is what's responsible for rising real estate values. Buy land, Mark Twain is reputed to have said, they're not making it anymore. But how does that narrative stand up to the evidence? Joining me on the podcast are two skeptics, infamous in their respective countries for challenging the housing supply shibboleth. Cameron Murray is an Australian economist and a research fellow at the University of Sydney's Henry Halloran Trust. And Ian Mulhern is based in England, where he is executive director and chief economist at the Tony Blair Institute. It was great to have both these economists, these mavericks of the housing supply myth, in on the same conversation, and I do hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Without much further ado, here is Cameron Murray and Ian Mulhern. Ian Mulhern, Cameron Murray, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you both here together to talk about the housing supply myth. I thought we'd best start by having each of you introduce himself, just so that people listening can associate the name with the voice. So, Ian, let's start with you. Just tell us your name, what you're doing at the moment.
So, I'm Ian Mulhern. I'm the Executive Director of UK Policy at the Tony Blair Institute in London. I've been researching housing issues for the last 4 or 5 years. And before I did this, I was an economic consultant, and back in the day, I worked at the UK Treasury as well. So I sort of come from a public policy kind of background, economist.
And Cam?
Yeah, Cameron Murray's my name. I'm a research fellow at the Henry Halloran Trust at the University of Sydney. Many years ago, I used to work for a property developer in Queensland, well, two different ones. So I've been thinking about housing a lot for a long time. Currently doing a lot of research on this bloody housing supply myth.
Well, what's interesting about each of you is that you're both famous or infamous in your respective countries, Ian, you in the UK, and Cam, you in Australia, for attacking this shibboleth of the housing market, which is that these historically high prices are a result of a lack of housing supply. And I think what's additionally interesting in terms of this conversation is that both Australia and the UK have had long-running housing booms by historical standards. I remember back in 2010, I think those were the two housing markets that the legendary billionaire investor Jeremy Grantham was waiting with bated breath to burst. And he was very surprised that, you know, every other housing bubble in history that had moved so many standard deviations from its long-run average had ended in a crash, but Australia and the UK held up through the Great Recession. Maybe an explanation for that is the prevalence of variable rate mortgages in our countries. In Australia, they account for about 84% of mortgages. Correct me if I'm wrong, Cam. I think it's something similar in the United Kingdom, Ian. Obviously, that's very different to the United States, where the norm is a fixed long-term mortgage. So there is some interesting commonalities there. We have had these decades-long booms. And on the face of it, the explanation is quite straightforward, or at least the public explanation, the public narrative is quite straightforward, and that is that supply is constrained and we've had these booms in net immigration and house prices are a simple function of supply and demand. And when demand outstrips supply, the price goes up. That's the explanation that we've all been led to believe. So we will come to this narrative. But first, Ian, I want to ask you how you came to be involved in this question of housing supply. Do you remember the moment you first started considering it?
Yes. Well, I guess I've long been considering it, mainly because I've been for far too long trying to work out whether it's sensible to buy a house or not in an overpriced city. So it's always been an interest, but I guess I suppose some kind of like interesting milestones, particularly, you know, in the UK, we started to produce data on rent levels, proper, you know, price index data on rent levels, some 6-7 years ago, I think now. And, you know, it had always been a puzzle to me about why we, you know, why we perhaps hadn't seen the impact that we might have expected from the financial crisis. You know, it was really when that data came out that it was like, hang on, something doesn't check out here. What we're seeing in the UK, what we've seen in the UK is very flat rents, really not going anywhere in real terms, and yet this massive volatility in house prices. And I guess for me, as somebody who hadn't thought hugely about it, that was the kind of canary in the coal mine, that the basic story cannot be right. I wasn't that confident in that initially, but I got quite much more heavily into modelling the house prices in later years, in sort of 2016, 2017, and I didn't really hold a strong view at that point. But once you start to get to grips with the theory behind it, and then you look at just the raw data, let alone any complicated econometric modelling, it starts to become clear what's happening here.
Cam, do you remember when you first started paying attention to the housing market in the Australian context?
Well, probably in 2003, when I bought my first investment property in the middle of a boom. Oh, no. By sheer luck. And was like, this is a really easy way to make money. I should do some more of this. And then realized, because it can't be like this forever. You know, this is an unusual way to just make money, is just throw money at houses and they give you back more money next year. Like, it's a pretty unusual thing. So I did start looking at it in detail, but I actually, I worked as a real estate agent for a little while, and I studied town planning and many different things in the property market. So I'd already always been aware of the inner workings of the planning system, and working for housing developers, what the general sort of strategies we would use were. And so every time I heard this myth, it sort of began in a 2003 paper, I think, by Chris Joy. He wrote it for the Menzies Research Center. It was a John Howard. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, Joe.
I am, yeah.
And he's the one who decided, for me, that report sort of was one of the first to put that story out, not from a developer lobby group, but from a sort of economics side. And it just seemed to roll, you know, as house prices went up, that was the great story. And I'll tell you an interesting story, because this is why I used to argue with Leith Van Onselen at Macro Business. At the beginning of that website, we were partners. We merged our blogs, I don't know if you recall, into Macro Business Superblog. And we would argue relentlessly. He would go, it's town planning. And I would say, it's not. Look at all these approvals. Look at all this supply. And that was around sort of the 2008, 9, 10 period. But here's a story that really cemented, I think, in my mind, why it's all nonsense. I was working for FKP, a developer up here in Queensland, and we had an apartment building at Mooloolaba that was going to go on sale. First weekend sale, got the sales office ready. And it was in the middle of a boom. And we had our price schedule. There was a queue out the door. We could have sold every single apartment in that morning. But at 10 a.m., after the first few groups had come through, we decided that we're going to stop selling apartments. We're going to close the sales office. We're going to delay the release for some fictitious reason so that we can boost all the prices up 20%. And it took us something like 5 years to sell the rest of them. So we could have sold them all Saturday morning, but instead we decided it's best to put the prices up and dribble them out. And I remember when I left, we still couldn't flog off the penthouse in this full constructed building. And they wait years and years. So that was really a defining story for me. I'm like, well, you know, just because it's approved and ready to build doesn't mean you're going to flog it off as quick as you can.
But Ian, it's sort of intuitive, isn't it? Like, we've had these huge booms in immigration, both in the UK and in Australia. We see NIMBYism everywhere in our major cities. Why isn't it supply that's driving up house prices in the United Kingdom?
Well, I think, this is one of the misperceptions, I guess, of most things that I say on this, and I suspect the same is true for Cameron, is that people often assume that what you mean is, the population size or the number of houses has no impact on prices. And obviously that's not true. Of course it does. This is only a question of what's the relative scale of effects. And, you know, there's a lot of houses in Australia and a lot of houses in the UK. And so small changes in population really don't have a huge effect. And it's an empirical question. You know, obviously, what is the scale of an increase in house prices as a result of change in population or the number of houses? So I think that's the first thing to say. But I think the other side of it is that, and that relationship is relatively weak. But the other thing to say is that the unintuitive bit is that the it's not just, I mean, obviously the number of houses, the number of households, and the incomes of those houses are going to be an important driver of house prices. But the unintuitive bit is the cost of capital and the cost of owning a house and the importance that has in determining house prices. And I think for most people, that's the bit that is difficult to get your head around, and that leads people to kind of miss the big mover in this story that does most of the heavy lifting when it comes to changing prices.
Yeah,
hold that thought for a moment. Just give me a sense of how many more houses we've been building than, you know, households that have been forming in the United Kingdom over the last however many years.
So, it's all pre-corona now. The numbers in my head are somewhat rusty, but it's roughly for the last 25 years, when you look at the figures, I think we've been adding about 170,000 households a year. And we have been building something like 190,000. I can't remember the exact figures, but the gap is about 20,000 to 30,000 a year. So over the course of 20 years, you get sort of a very build up in the excess number of houses over the number of households.
Cam, is that also true in Australia? That general point?
The general point is, I'm just having a quick look at what sort of documents I have on this, but I have a paper called The Housing Supply Myth, and I reckoned that we built about 500,000 additional dwellings compared to households in the last two decades. That's my sort of adjusted total. Dwellings minus households, yeah. So if we had the same rate of growth of dwellings as we did of households from around 2000, we'd have 500,000 fewer houses than what we actually built, which is quite a lot, I guess. There are around 10 million households in Australia. So what's that, 5%? Oh, yeah. 0.5.
Wow.
What am I up to, dividing 10 million by a half? Anyway.
Ian, you mentioned the cost of capital. Just talk a little bit about that and the role that these long declines in interest rates have played in pushing up house prices in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, so so I guess the way, you know, in a sort of simple terms, the way to think of the relationship between, I think, you know, one of the problems is that people think about the number of houses, number of households, the incomes of those households, and they think that directly determines the house price. And for many people, that house price then determines what rents flow from it. But it's kind of get it the wrong way around, because really the thing that's being priced in the market is the market for housing services, i.e. the rent. And so the number of households, the number of houses, and their incomes is the kind of equation that determines what the level of rent is in the market for a given house. And if those variables change, then rents can go up or down. But how houses get priced is effectively people discount the future stream of rents on a given house. If you buy a house, you're buying the right not to have to pay rent on that thing forever and a day. So how much is it worth to not for you not to have to pay rent on that? Well, the standard way of doing it is that you take the interest rate, what you could earn on the money somewhere else, and you use that to discount this rental stream, and that gets you to your house price today. So obviously, if interest rates go up to 10%, then your valuation of a stream of rental payments is going to be much lower in terms of a lump sum today than if it was 1%. In which case, the future stream of payments it looms pretty large, and the present value of it is very high, and so that's why, even though you've got very flat, very stable levels of rent that really only move with incomes, that can still be consistent with very volatile house prices, because the rate at which people discount the future is changing all the time. And that's what we've seen particularly over the last 25 years or so, particularly since the Asian financial crisis, I guess you might say. We've seen this global interest rates dropping, and again, even further and harder since the financial crisis, which has led people to, assess the present value of that future stream of rent much more highly. And that's why the prices are where they are.
Do you think the present value relation is really the model of the economy that's in the public's mind?
Definitely not. No. And I think, that's partly because of the sort of, people think of housing as a good, just like going and buying a can of baked beans. But it's not. It's obviously it's an investment that yields a stream of services over time. So the other thing is kind of the confusion of the relationship between rents and prices. People thinking that rents are a result of a given house price rather than the other way around. So I think it's definitely down to some of those confusions. I think that the story is kind of unintuitive for a lot of people.
Cam, I'm conscious we haven't mentioned the nasty B word yet. That is to say, bubble. but this is a contentious topic down under, as it has been in the United Kingdom for decades as well. And when Ian speaks about the present value relation, it leads me to question whether house prices are a reflection of intrinsic value. What do you think about that question? How do you make heads and tails of that?
Well, I think the missing factor, Ian's explanation was perfect, and I couldn't have said it better. Thank you. But the added part to that is that not only are you buying the right not to pay that stream of rent into the future, you're also buying the right to any accumulation in the capital gain that occurs over time. So your total return to buying that house is two things. It's the flow of rent plus that value of that right to get the capital gain. And so when capital gains are rising, regardless of the level of interest rate, you will actually pay a premium for that right to get that additional capital growth in the future, that additional return coming from the capital growth. And so you can sort of see that the reduction in interest rates itself increases the price. The increasing price is observed, and then people add that into what their total expectations of total returns are, and then they pay for that increase in price that they've just observed. And because they're willing to pay for that, that increases the price further, and the next buyer observes that increase in price. So I think you do get these bubbles and feedbacks. And quite clearly, in Australia, we had the Royal Commission into Banking a few years ago, and prices fell 20% in Sydney because we constrained the ability of new buyers to capitalise and borrow and leverage up into that cycle that was going on. Mm-hmm. So I think that's pretty clear evidence. But that's the other thing that we need to be aware of, is that, if we tax capital gains at 100%, so you didn't have to, you would, couldn't own that right to that capital gain, then the world would be the capitalization model that Ian's talking about. You're just buying out your right to rents. But because we do get that extra bit, it adds a lot of volatility to the market, especially when you have, you know, the ammunition of a banking sector that is willing to just hand buyers who have these crazy expectations the money that they think they need. The other interesting thing that Ian mentioned that I just wanted to build on was that the rent is the price of the supply and demand determined price for houses, and that the house price is like the asset price. So, you know, you can think of the rent as the price of an iPhone, and the house price is the value of an Apple share in the company that makes that. When I say, you know, it's not supply, people think I'm saying supply doesn't matter. I'm saying it does matter. We should observe it in rents, which is the price of houses. If there was a shortage of iPhones, you would see them being sold on Gumtree at premium prices. Okay? The price of Apple shares could do whatever. I don't know for what market reasons that might change, but we should see that. We should see them on Gumtree. And so we're going to have very good evidence now that we do have a lot of houses in the economy somewhere, in society, because Airbnb is basically switching off. It is done for 2020. And we're going to see what happens when you supply houses to households that were just sitting there, not used for residential occupancy, but tourist accommodation. And we're going to see that effect come through rents. Anything could happen to prices because of changing expectations of capital growth, but we're going to see that supply and demand in action coming in rents. And it may very well be the case that we have negative, you know, rental growth for quite a period of time. And the puzzling thing will be that this supply myth will still not die, even if we have a period of negative rental growth for multiple years. What were you going to say, Ian?
Yeah, no, I was just going to, there's a lot there. I completely agree. I mean, just on the bubbles point, I think one thing that's interesting is, and I guess it, I think it's the same certainly in Sydney and Melbourne, but definitely in London. You know, what you had before, one of the things when I say this, tell this story, is that people will say, well, hang on a second, back in 2007, interest rates were nearly as low as they are today. And you know, prices were, you know, the prices in the UK are basically back up at those peaks. So really, if we look over the last 13, 14 years, prices actually haven't really changed. They've gone down and up again. They haven't really changed, and interest rates have fallen. And I think, you know, it's the pre-2007 period where you'd see in the UK, and the Bank of England's modeled this now, only after some of us have been talking about it for quite a long time, but has now been modeling it and has shown, you know, that when you run this kind of a model, discounting model, you can see that bubble in the data. It's very clear in the run up to 2007, where you get this divergence of prices from what the discounting model would justify, because people have been able to get their hands on the money. There's been this overshoot that Cameron explained, and therefore you've got this bubble. So, you know, people say, well, are these high prices a bubble or not? And I say, well, in 2007, they were a bubble. They were not justified by the fundamentals, but now they are justified by the fundamentals. And that's kind of difficult for people to get their head around. You know, some people might say it's a bubble because we might see reversion of interest rates to more normal levels, which would cause a price crash. But I would see that as a fundamental driver of prices. So I wouldn't describe it as a bubble myself.
There's also the possibility, Ian, though, that the expectation of declining prices becomes embedded. And so as well as, you know, paying off in the price, buying out the right to pay rent for that house and instead paying the price up front, what you're going to see is that, well, you also then have to pay that price and then lose the value of your capital gain each year. So a sort of Japanese stagnation view is that even though interest rates are low, the price can be below the capitalized flow of rents because there's an expectation of continual decline. And I mean, I see that more as driven by long-run demographic trends. more so than these 10 to 20 year cycles. But that is still a possibility that you can have low interest rates with high prices, which are justified, as you say, but then have low interest rates and low prices because you're buying a depreciating asset in some ways. Yeah. So I think that's also a possibility. And I don't hear people talk about it much, but I think in the next 10 to 15 years, we will, when the baby boomers start dropping off and their kids realize they have 15 houses they don't want that they've inherited and maybe want to sell them off. We'll see.
I mean, I think the London story is kind of the other version. Is it the same story, but the other way around? Like, what role is there for these kind of expectation-driven divergences from? Because this is the other challenge that I get is, you know, how come there's such variation in the yield? So the yield is obviously the rent as a proportion of the price, the market price of houses, and in London it looks like the yield is very much lower than it is in the rest of the country. And I think a similar story plays out in Australia.
Yeah, that's right.
So in other words, why are price, if it's just straightforwardly discounting, if that's the story, there shouldn't be that difference in yield. And I mean, one of the stories has to be, the IMF has done work on this and looked at globally integrated, financial hubs around the world and how they may be more exposed to these kind of changes, but there may also just be a straightforward expectations thing. I mean, certainly in the UK you get these kind of stories that London's invincible and whatever. They may be myths, but that's what people think, but I think that is a huge area of our kind of, we just don't know about a lot of these
things. You're right, and I guess the only thing I'd add to that expectations of the tier one cities versus the regional cities is that often banks will be more willing to land up more. So there's a bit of feedback in with if the banking, the lending ammunition for buyers. We know that in certain periods of time there were blacklisted suburbs where banks wouldn't lend because there were high risk areas, so that sort of feeds into those expectations as well. Whereas those blue chip prime big city areas, those mechanisms of constraint aren't there.
And just to kind of come back on that again, that actually one of the most frustrating objections I get is people saying, well, if it's all about interest rates, then everywhere should be doing the same, and therefore it can't. There's this idea that because you can't explain every movement in a market price, that invalidates the basis of housing economics for the last 30 years. It's just ridiculous. I mean, the idea that it's just straightforwardly interest rates. And then straight on through. I mean, institutions, lending policies, narratives, they all interfere with the transmission from one to the other. But that doesn't change the fact that the tide is global interest rates.
Correct. And the one thing I mentioned to Joe earlier when we were chatting is a lot of these Rust Belt areas in the US with low house prices and apparently unlimited supply and great planning scarcity systems, the Houstons, Atlantas, or whatever's. Did I say Rust Belt? The southern US cities in Texas particularly. They have very high property taxes, right? And so that's another factor in this capitalization of the flow that keeps the prices low. So you can say, oh, it's 50% cheaper there. But of course, you've just also bought this massive property tax liability to go with it. Of course, you're not going to pay as much money. And so you get this whole weird literature that is sprung up using this wrong measure, this house price measure that we know is affected by banking and expectations and all these other feedbacks and taxation and interest rates. And we go, no, that's our measure of the supply of housing, when you can just count houses and look at the price of rents. Like, do you ever find anyone looks at rents in this sort of area? I've not seen it. Maybe because the story is not in rents, it doesn't exist.
Sorry, Kevin, what do you mean? There's people who think there's a supply shortage?
Correct,
rents.
Yeah.
No, there's none of that. but you're right, they don't want to look at it. And I haven't heard any decent rejoinder about how you can explain this stuff. I mean, you're absolutely right that so much of the literature revolves around trying to explain something that is very, very hard to explain in its totality, i.e. the many, many factors that drive house prices. Meanwhile, theory and basic economics tell us your story should be evident in this much more simple relationship between rents and supply. And so, I think it's slowly percolating through into the debate, but it is remarkable how, and I think it's something deeply, it says something deep about how our societies operate, that, certainly in the UK, there's such a fetishization of home ownership. Therefore, somehow house prices are in some sense superior or more important than rents, which are just some, kind of artifact,
totally,
things that 25-year-olds do. And as a result, all the things we should be thinking about are just prices. And it's like, let's strip this down and try and model something much simpler that can shed light on this question. And we don't see, a lot of people just don't seem to be prepared to do that.
No, and when I ever criticize this, I always say, can you do the same exercise with rents now and then we can talk? But no one's come back to me.
I wonder whether part of it is also that for many years you've had rent controls and therefore it's just not been possible. I mean, certainly in the UK, until there was a decent price index produced by the ONS, it's been almost impossible to stack this up as anything other than a theory. But maybe that's true in other countries as well. I don't know.
Similar price index problems, but I mean, I don't think it's any worse than house prices. And we've got plenty of, decades now of good data.
Yeah.
There just seems to be a tangled web of causality when it comes to explaining prices. And I'm trying to sort out the different causes. And part of the issue is many of them we can't observe. So we rely on these models, which are prone to omitted variable bias. And I'm trying to think through. So for a long time, the way I thought about interest rates was that they were essentially permissive of high house prices rather than necessarily causing them. And that is to say, it was like opening the floodgates, but the force of gravity that was driving the water down the hill was expectations as to future house price rises. So those are, your narratives and your optimism, extrapolative beliefs. And then I kind of thought maybe the model of the economy in the public's mind probably wasn't the present value relation. People weren't, discounting their future rental cash flows in spreadsheets and working out how the value of their home should be appropriately priced. But maybe in a world of like secular, long-term, low or negative real rates, maybe the public would cotton on to the fact that interest rates played a really important role. And so maybe the public would like eventually learn. Do you have any reactions to that, either of you? I'm just kind of thinking out loud here.
Property investors in Australia, all the ones I know, are pure interest rate machines. They just say, is the interest rate below the yield? All right, let's buy some houses. And I think, interest rates do facilitate, but I think human nature for this free money and the leverage available to get it, I mean, you still have to have the expectation that that capital value is sustained or growing. I think people, most of the sort of price moving investors in the market are pretty aware of it, I would say. What do you think, Ian?
Just to sort of reprise really what we were just saying, I guess, as a sort of starting point. So it's like, we've got the basic relationship between houses, households, incomes that drive rents. And then the question is, what's their impact on prices? But you've got all of these other things going on, the cost of capital, expectations, regulation, global capital markets, narratives, lending policy to banks, all of these things. So you're kind of right, Joseph, that I think it's like it's a necessary but insufficient condition to have a sustained rise in house prices that you have a sustained drop in in interest rates. I mean, you could have rising house prices yes. for a bubble, but bubbles aside,
yeah.
That's a necessary but not sufficient condition. So Germany's regulation of mortgages is much tighter. And so it's not that surprising, really, that they've been able to keep a lid on these kind of things. I think it probably... I think you're probably right that people are more likely... There's a couple of things going on. First of all, once you end this 40-year bull run of house prices, the dinner party chat of prices always go up probably stops. So maybe some of that expectation stuff starts to damp down. And then also, critically, in the UK, once you've got people taking out 40-year mortgages or whatever, it's looking just like rent. You know, your mortgage payment is... basically your rent, and
yeah, exactly.
and people start to see the two. And so I think there probably is a point where you get to where people are like, hang on, all I'm doing is taking on capital risk, and otherwise it's basically rent.
Yeah.
But I kind of wonder, like, you know, what people are effectively doing is, you know, what is the better thing to do? Is it to put all your money in a single asset that's completely undiversified, the costs of fortune, and the might at any point tank in value? Or is it better to diversify your investments and use the stream of income you get from it to carry on paying the rent? And for some reason, people think the latter is more risky than the former, which is completely the wrong way around, in my view.
Yeah, look, I think the main reason I've seen for that is that the stability of the renting is the risk, the having to move house. You had much more stable renting laws, much more security of being able to stay. And I think that changes that equation as well.
Yeah, agreed. Hmm. Yeah.
How do we think about narratives in housing markets? Bob Shiller started working on narrative economics in a more formal sense beginning in 2017. Then he had a book out last year called Narrative Economics. And one of the chapters is dedicated to narratives in housing markets. And narratives like exogenous creations and stories that exist out there in the ether that can possess people like mind viruses and drive economic events. You know, narratives like safe as houses or... the insert country here dream, narratives like the supply myth. Where do these narratives come from? Do you think of them in an exogenous way in the context of economic models, or are they just ornamental post hoc rationalizations that people tell themselves and tell each other so they can sleep better at night, where really there are other more important forces driving their economic decision making?
What a question.
I mean, I would say much more the latter. I go for the other. Yeah, it's the latter. I mean, you know,
you think?
Cameron might be different in different places to me on this, but I do think that, you know, when you look at the hard data, aside from a few years where momentum carries prices above where they should be, by the fundamentals, you know, pretty much you take your interest rates and you can figure out what the, and your rents, and you figure out what the prices are going to be, give or take. So I think a lot of it's just ex post rationalization. I think the one thing that challenges that is, as I say, within the UK, for example, the geographic differences, where it's possible that narratives about London and stuff are more powerful. But I still am somewhat skeptical about that. I think it's something to do with the kind of liquidity of the market, things like that. But
I mostly agree. I would say it's a sort of rationalization of following the trend, and that narrative is the mechanism that sort of perpetuates fads and fashions. And it's not the reason we do it. We do it because we're human beings and we're social creatures that have certain needs, and we do it by instinct. And then we go, that's the story that makes me feel best about what I just did to feel good. And because everyone else is doing it, I feel good. I didn't think economically about the decision. I thought like an animal, a social animal that I am. And then I rationalized it with my conscious mind, and now we have great dinner party conversations about why that story is the best of all stories and how smart we are for buying houses at $1 million a pop. could you spark a housing bubble by telling stories? If you owned a large media empire, could you just tell the big lie or feed the myth through your empire? And
that's a really interesting way of phrasing the question.
That's essentially what the housing lobby's done with the supply myth, right? They've orchestrated through their media and their lobby groups a story that makes us feel good about overpaying for houses because there's a supply constraint. They're not making any more houses.
Yeah.
So I think there's a bit of that.
But yeah, that's true. But still, if you just discount the rent, you get to the prices you've got. So like, for all the brouhaha about narratives and stuff, and clearly there are some strong narratives out there, it doesn't seem to be like people paying £1 million for a terraced house on my street, not that my street houses go for £1 million, but is perfectly rational because interest rates are so low. It's not irrational. It's not based on a narrative. Well, not solely.
Yeah. Oh, look, I think if you're looking at the blue chip, the Sydney and Melbourne and, what do you call them? Tier one cities that have this sort of expectation built in. I think that's where it plays out. And you'll notice in Australia, for example, I live in Brisbane, that housing supply myth is quiet. It's all Sydney and Melbourne talking about it because they're feeding this sort of behavior, these expectations. Whereas outside of that, it doesn't really exist. So look, maybe I don't have a good answer. I just wanted to tell you that.
Whether or not the housing supply myth is like an exogenous story that Bob Shiller would kind of try and take and taxonomize, or whether it's just a convenient post hoc rationalization, I'm still interested in where it came from. I'm interested in like a sociological account of the housing supply myth. And I guess the first thing to note is that we've observed it through history in housing bubbles of the past. It often pops up, which is not really surprising because it offers quite an intuitive explanation for price rises. But currently we observe it in Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, Canada, the US, essentially the Five Eyes countries, I guess you could say, but as well other countries around the Anglosphere. And it's interesting how prevalent it is. It's interesting. So I go to a lot of property investor seminars, or at least I used to, just as an observer. And this was like the main narrative that was dragged out to explain Australian house prices. And it's usually the first thing that rolls off somebody's tongue when you ask them for an account of house prices, at least in my experience. Cam, that probably checks out for you as well, I'm guessing. And the last guest I had on the podcast was Malcolm Turnbull, who was Australia's previous Prime Minister. And I had to read his memoir ahead of the interview. I was talking about it with Cam before we started recording. But I struck upon his explanation of housing unaffordability in Australia. And again, it's just quite a blasé reference to the housing supply myth. And I'll quote him directly from page 320. If housing was too expensive, the answer was to build more houses. And that meant reforms to planning so that supply could respond more readily to demand. So almost everywhere we look in public policy narratives, the notion is that house prices are high because we're not building enough, which is a result of either geographic constraints or NIMBYism. But do you have any insights, either of you, into where this myth, spreading as it does across many countries in the Anglosphere, originated, and why today it still exercises such a hold over the imaginations of policymakers and economists and the general public? So there's two parts to that question.
I think it probably makes sense for me to start with that in the UK, because I think Cameron will have probably a better sense of lots of places around the world. It'd be interesting to see if you think the same things hold. Mm-hmm. I think for the UK, I think there are, I've just been trying to note them down, but I think there are probably five things that have driven this. One is just the simplicity, right? You can't be wrong for saying more supply will lower prices in any market, right? So people just come with their economics 101 and they're like, and their pub chat, and they're like, yeah, you're not going to be wrong for writing that in your memoir, right? So that's the first thing, simplicity. The second reason it takes hold is because none of your fancy stories, Cameron, you know, just keep it simple. Then the second thing is like the long, you know, probably since Volcker, right, declining interest rates story that's been critical. So when that just, you've got a non-stationary time series, you know, that's just going to, that gets embedded into a whole generation of people who made money from prices always going up, and that kind of fed the narrative. The third thing is in the UK particularly, and I think in lots of countries, including Australia, you've seen this kind of household size declined rapidly in the middle, late 20th century, and then started to bottom out at around, I don't know, 2 to 2.5 people per household in the UK. At least it sort of ended up around, I think, 2.3 or something like that. And in successive censuses, or estimates of household formation rates were always based on the past rapid decline in household size. Yeah. So as it started to bottom out, there was a persistent in the UK for several decades, persistent overestimation of the rate of household formation. So people would go to housing conferences, show these terrifying charts of the number of households that were forming each year and the number of houses we were building, and look at the gap. And that went on time after time after time, because we were always looking in the rearview mirror to see what had happened to you know, social norms about housing, household size. So that really fed it with some good hard empirical data that was actually just wrong. The fourth thing I think is this primacy of ownership story. So people just kind of misunderstanding the role of rents, and that's partly related to the simplicity thing. And the fifth thing I think is just, again, sort of relates to simplicity, but the misunderstanding that there are two markets here. This isn't like the price of baked beans or the price of something else. You know, you've got two markets, two prices. The market for housing services is the rental price. The market for housing assets is the house price. It's just like Cameron's example of the iPhone price versus the Apple share price. These are different markets with different prices, and people just don't get that. So when you put all those things together, that's, I think, why the UK debate is where it is.
I agree with all that. That was good. And now I've forgotten the question. I was just enjoying the answer. But
is that true elsewhere, do you think?
Yeah, I would say so. And I think that's all the reasons that it's such a good story. The question is, though, stories need storytellers, and they need someone who has an interest in banging this drum. And I have a book called Game of Mates, How Favours Bleed the Nation, which is about how political favours are given out and how we socially organise to corrupt the system for our benefit. And the beautiful thing about property is we have rules that apply to what you can do with it, and that can vary its value quite significantly. And so the property development industry likes to buy plots of land that, where the rules say you can farm this land, this is agricultural purposes. And then they need a story, if they want to get some free money, about why those rules should be changed so you can build high-rise buildings there. And that driver, when you have in Australia huge multi-billion dollar listed companies, thousands and thousands of small developers whose main boundary where they can exert influence to make more money is through changing the planning system, you're going to have a huge number of storytellers lining up to perpetuate this story every single day. because there's this free money on the line, because they want the planning system changed, not so that houses can be cheaper. I mean, what sort of idiot property developer would I be if I was lobbying to flood my market with competition and make housing prices cheaper? I mean, the insanity of that alone should stop this. But of course, people don't think logically. They like the simplicity that you were talking about. So I think, you know, that's what's going on in the background. There is an economic motive with many, many storytellers who are very politically connected to jump on this bandwagon. And we legitimized that. In Australia, we had the National Housing Supply Council created in 2008 after the pre-financial crisis boom. You know, what's the problem with Australia's housing supply? And what, the most awesome thing about this is that they made these 10-year projections about housing need, which we can now look back at. And they made these population projections, of which the lowest that they made was higher than the population growth we had, despite us massively increasing migrant intake in that very year. We still didn't reach the lowest population projection, but we actually exceeded on the housing supply their highest of three projections. So they thought we, so we built essentially 1.5 million new homes when, according to their forecast back in 2008, we would have only needed 1.2. So we've far exceeded that. And yet this myth is still there. It's just crazy. Because it makes you money, right? I've looked at presentations done by lobbyists for developers to politicians. And they've said, oh, we need to change this huge piece of agricultural land into residential subdivisions because there's a housing shortage. We're going to solve the housing crisis of this town. We're going to build 30,000 new houses in this massive subdivision. Okay, great. They get approved. In their prospectus to investors, they say, we got an approval that's going to last us at least 35 years. And I'm like, whose housing supply crisis are you solving? You've just promised to flood the market here, but what you really wanted was the to write up the value of your land because of that change in zoning, and you're just going to drip feed at the same rate you would have if you could build half as many. So that's what I think is the big thing, and that's been an issue I've been harping on about since I worked on the other side of a fence and found it very disheartening that was the main business of property development.
Yeah, so I really shouldn't have missed that sixth one, which is absolutely critical, the interest groups, right? But I guess also, and this is, I think it kind of goes to the heart of the problem, is that in the public narrative, you have this, why would, it must be developers aren't, they don't want to build because they will bust the market price. And one of the things that I'm always saying is, well, they can't really do that. None of them are big enough, or even if they didn't want to drip feed them out over 30 years, none of them are really big enough to massively dent their own profits by dumping stuff out there. But what it, where the narrative really suits them is that they can get this, you know, markup on the land because they managed to tell everybody there's a shortage, so you need more permissions. Yeah. And that's the, I think, the real trouble. But the other thing is, and Cameron, I know you want to come back on that, but the other thing is, I think also you see all the actors around, and it's not malicious or anything, but all the actors around this debate also echo it because it's in their interest to do so. So Turnbull there in his book, or like we just had a thing in the UK where the BBC did some big splash on housing, a apparently really detailed report, which they apparently got no experts in housing to really write. And they sort of echo around the simple message because it's in people's, they think, you know, I'll just weigh in on the side that's simple and everybody gets around the dinner table rather than, and that sort of bolsters this story. And it's very hard, in a sense. It's a bit like the reproduction number of, coronavirus, right? It's like, what is the R of your story about housing? Yeah. And unfortunately, the R of the simple and rubbish and wrong story is extremely high. It tears through middle-class dinner parties.
Yeah. Like, oh, my God.
And R1 doesn't.
Look, that is so good. You're totally right. And let me just add the final ingredient in that storytelling, part and the vested interests. Just remember, these vested interests who tell this story don't want house prices to fall. Their interest is the opposite. So by talking about planning, constraining supply, they've ensured that all the policy focus is on the thing that's not really going to do anything, and it's no risk to them. It's because what I always say is, oh, is there a housing supply shortage? We should go build some houses then. Oh, no, 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 no. What you need to do is give me some rezoning and some new permissions, right? I'm like, no, maybe the government should just build 200,000 dwellings a year. I mean, like, if there was a submarine shortage, would we just issue permissions to build submarines, or would we just bloody well order them to be built and pay for it? And they go, oh, no, 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 no. Oh, yeah, we could do a bit more public housing maybe. I'm like, no, just flood the market. If you think this is it, that's your answer. But they don't want the answer to their question. They just want the story, in my view. Maybe that's a tad extremely cynical.
But Cam, presumably you'd also agree that even if they did that, I mean, if in the UK, even if they doubled the rate of building, or they hit, you know, they hit this fancy target of 300,000 houses a year in England over the cycle. I mean, you know, on our figures, it's kind of like, well, after 20 years, you might lower prices by 10%. Now, in the context of prices having, you know, almost tripled over the last 20 years in real terms, yeah, that's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, it is a drop.
So, like, even if they do this, it's not going to...
No, that's true. You know, but I think that's once it's smoothed out. But if you put 200 extra houses for sale each year... Do you know what I'm saying? Then the market of trades would be like, well, we can't find the buyers for that. We have to drop the price. We've got...
Right, so fire sale.
Yeah, you just flood it. And I'm actually, it's quite interesting, the political problems with this. In the ACT, where Canberra is, for our foreign listeners, Australia's capital, the territory government actually is the land developer monopolist. So they own all the non-urban land and they drip feed it to the market. And I've had a lot of discussion with, you know, people in the minister's offices there. And I said, well, you know, you keep issuing all these reports about house prices and stuff. Why don't you just flood the market till you get to the price you want? You're the monopolist. And they're like, yeah, well, we can't do that because then everyone's house prices will fall. We don't want prices to go down. I'm like, well, why are you pretending with decades of reports analyzing what are the causes we want to know, when you actually don't want the outcome itself? And that's a crazy thing that's how it works. I mean, it makes sense, right? We've got 7 million homeowning households. We've got 1.8 million investor households. We've got $7 trillion worth of housing in Australia. A 10% fall is a lot of money. You know, $700 billion off everyone's balance sheets to highly concentrated at the wealthiest. It's political suicide, really. I actually said this at a conference, a housing conference last year. I said, well, do you guys even want prices to be lower? I feel like you've been here for 10 years saying the same stuff. You know, isn't it just political suicide for you to do anything about it? And a few people started cheering because, yeah, you got to think about that as well.
This also plays into, sorry, Joseph, you might want to take it off in a different direction. I don't know.
No, I'm enjoying this.
I was going to say that this plays into the other debate that sometimes happens, which is, so what happens if you do get some interest rate normalization or whatever? I mean, I obviously looking pretty unlikely right now, but some people say, well, you know, interests are so, you know, strongly aligned with keeping prices high that they will step in, stop the market falling. And in my view, that's just impossible, really. I mean, I don't see how, you know, the UK government can prop up, you know, $7 or $8 trillion pound housing market with without putting vast amounts of taxpayers' money behind it, and even then probably not credibly. I mean, what do you think, Cameron? Do you think there's any way, you know, fiscal authorities or whoever, financial regulators, can do anything to maintain high prices if the fundamentals shifted?
That's a very good question. Look, I think if we were in that situation, I'm wondering what other economic fallouts there might be that are more top of mind, because, you know, a large and sustained fall, look, I think there'd have to be efforts, you know, stabilizing the market would be the mantra, even though it's really quite funny because for years you'd go, we want cheaper houses and now we don't. look, I think they'd be politically fairly limited, as you say. Yeah. I'll have to put some thought into that, actually. Good question.
I mean, I reckon they could probably...
What do you think, Ian, if you were the government and you were trying to rescue the market in that situation, what would be the first policy that you would cook up?
Well, that's the thing. I really struggle to see how you can do it. I mean, ultimately, you know, on the basic discounting model, if you make it far more costly to own a house or try and make it far more, I mean, you know, people just aren't going to, they're just not going to buy them. You know, if the daily cost, day-to-day cost is higher than just of renting them, but the people are just going to wait till the market reaches its equilibrium. So I think that's the one thing. I mean, obviously they can do all sorts of things, like they can ease, you know, capital buffers and things like that. And they can perhaps, I don't know, you know, force the banks into forbearance, and they can, you know, perhaps beef up housing benefit for homeowners, and they can do all these things, which will probably stop a fire sale. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it changes the market equilibrium.
You know, I've got a couple of questions about your critique of the housing supply myth in the United Kingdom. So I just want to push back a little bit, and I'm sure you've got good answers to these, but, and I'm sure also we might have implicitly touched on the answers as well throughout the conversation, but I just want to kind of get them on the record anyway. The first question is, you mentioned that we've been building an excess of homes over the past, say, 25 years, give or take. And the response to that is to say that, sure, the shortage might have been getting smaller over that period, but maybe we were so behind to begin with that there's still an overall shortage. So is there a question as to when you begin measuring, like what the start date is?
Well, okay, so essentially back in, the raw figures are, that back in 1996, you had like about 660,000 more houses than there were households in England. And then that had grown by 2019, that's up at about 1.2 million or something like that. So the surplus stock has kind of doubled. So it's true to say that the, you know, some people criticize that and they say, well, you know, what's a surplus house? Is that a good measure of spare capacity? You know, those are all fair criticisms. You know, you don't want to put too much weight on what it means to have 600,000 spare houses. Is that enough? Who knows? What does enough mean? All sorts of things. But what we can say is that if it's hard to, even on those kind of contentious figures, it's pretty hard to stack up the idea of a growing shortage, i.e. a shortage that's just getting worse, when that surplus number is trending very clearly and persistently in one direction over 25 years. So I think that's the thing. It's like not putting too much weight on the actual measure, but it's just saying like, the challenge is back to the dominant narrative. How do you explain this? How do you explain it when you know, what we expect to see when we see this measure of surplus capacity trending in one direction, but we'd expect to see rents versus incomes trending in the other direction, and we have. So, you know, all the bits of the story check out. So it's more like just saying, well, you know, we need an explanation for this if we're to believe this shortage story, and that's one where we never really hear one.
All right, second pushback, just giving voice to the critics here and playing devil's advocate. So, sure, a lack of housing supply may not be the overriding problem in this situation, but maybe injecting a surplus of housing supply into the market would be a solution. What do you make of that response?
Yeah, so this kind of goes back to the point I was making earlier that it's not wrong to say more houses would lower prices, and they would. Quite often the argument that we're making is boiled down to claim that we're denying that, and we're not at all. It's just that, you know, as I say, you've got this kind of very large stock of houses, and it takes, you know, even building very large numbers of housing, implausibly large numbers of houses in the UK, is not going to radically change the size of the UK housing stock anytime soon. And then into the bargain, the sensitivity of house prices to that change in stock is, you know, it's 1% more houses will get you 2% off prices. It's there, but like, you know, it's not massively sensitive. It's not unusually sensitive. So you put those two facts together, and what you see is, you have to build huge amounts of housing for many years before you get house prices back to anything that people might have previously considered to be affordable in terms of a ratio to their income. So, you know, if we build 300,000 houses a year in the UK, and bear in mind we've been in England over the next 20 years, you know, bear in mind we've been kind of doing under 200,000 for the last 25 years. So if we add 50% to that for the next 20 years, then you're going to maybe take 10% off house prices compared to what they otherwise would have been. But I don't really see that that's massively helping the people who've just seen price to incomes more than double over the last generation. You know, that's not going to make all these millennials go, oh, hallelujah, housing is really cheap, we can afford it. So they're going to get to the end of 20 years with all these great promises and find out they're still completely unaffordable. So it has an effect. It's just that it doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah. Can I add 2 points to that?
Sure.
I've done the numbers for Australia as well. And my numbers with a 1% elasticity is you increase construction rate for 50% for 10 years, which from the record highs from Australia, and you get a 7% reduction in house prices after a decade. And, you know, and I can tell people, that's how much prices went up in June 2013 in Sydney.
Yeah.
There's more to it, right? This is a 50% increase in total housing construction. Housing construction is something like 7% of GDP and 8% of the workforce. So you're going to somehow have this macroeconomic cost of hauling 4% of the workforce from what they're doing and getting them on the tools to build more houses for a decade. For 10%, it's a massive macroeconomic cost. It's like implausibly high. People go, oh, we should just double construction. I'm like, you want to take it from 8 to 16% of GDP every year? This is like wartime type of build-ups. And you're just like, oh, it's really easy. Just change a few town planning rules, change the gross floor area limit, mate, and we'll do it. I'm like, you're insane.
Yeah.
That's
And the story goes on further too, right? In the way these models work, all of them is, you know, they're based on some measure of spare capacity. What is the spare capacity in the market? So when you see, you know, in England, you've got this kind of doubling of the number of surplus empty homes. What we're saying is we need to kind of, I haven't quite got the figures to hand, but we're saying, oh yeah, 1.2 million empty homes isn't enough, we need 2.5 million empty homes. And it's like, so you're not only are you going to do the massive macroeconomic distortion that Cameron's talking about, but also nobody is going to consume those services because they're going to be empty. So what's the point? Wouldn't we rather spend our economic resources being able to create something that we actually want to consume rather than having empty houses? And the fact that this is difficult for people to grasp when we've just seen, you know, endless ghost estates appearing in Spain and Ireland and the US and as a result of a housing construction boom. And it just doesn't seem to compute that this is a waste, a massive capital misallocation that ends up reducing all our living standards. So the cost benefit analysis really needs to be done of what is the optimal level of spare capacity in the housing market. And you know, the UK at the moment, the spare capacity is about 5.5%, something like that. What is the optimal level that allows labor mobility and all the rest of it to operate unimpeded? I don't know. No one knows. Maybe it's a bit higher, maybe it's even a bit lower. I'm pretty sure it's not 10% plus. So, you know, we need to really reframe this debate. Instead of always saying always more is better, we need to have a much more nuanced cost benefit analysis of what's the appropriate level of spare capacity and how do we balance consuming empty houses with consuming other stuff that might make us have higher living standards.
I think the other, that's exactly the point that no one seems to want to talk about. But I think to your original question, Joe, what does injecting supply mean? Are we pretending that changing a few town planning laws are going to do this? And I think a lot of people are pretending that. The evidence is just not there that if developers have more lots of land, that they sell them faster. They're not going to inject supply. And I think it brings me to one of my real bugbears about urban economics. And I've come around to calling urban economics the art of confusing the optimal density of housing per unit of land with the optimal rate of new housing supply per period across all sites with development options. And so you end up with this confusion that, it's profitable to build this high rise and we on this piece of land, that's high density. That means there's going to be a lot of new homes. But it's actually optimal to build that high rise at that density, but also to sell it over a 5 to 8 year period. Okay. So in density terms, yes, it's very dense, but in housing supply terms, it's 1/8 of that per year. And if your building was taller, it might be 1/10. That optimal number that you sell each year is probably the same regardless of the density. And so it's pretty, that's the other thing that really bugs me is that you just, approve some developers and they'll build it. So I don't know if you are aware, Ian, I went to the annual reports of Australia's top 8 listed housing developers and I added up their land banks and what they tell their investors about their intentions to supply and what they do when they get rezoned. And it's the exact opposite of what they tell the media, right? It's crazy. This is Lendlease. I'm going to quote from the annual report. The community's pipeline consists of an estimated 52,333 lots with an annual target of 3,000 to 4,000 completions. More than a decade of supply has already been secured. The development pipeline brings long-term earnings visibility and the flexibility to be disciplined and patient with the pursuit of future opportunities. So developers know they've got 52,000, you give them 55,000. They only want to build 3,000 a year because they want to wait. In Australia, we've got, in Queensland, we've got 40,000 new detached housing lots zoned. How many do we produce a year? 6,000. 67 years worth. People go, I'll change the density. Change the density and you'll supply twice as quick. It makes no sense to me. It's a classic mistake because of the simplicity you were talking about. People see a high rise. It looks like a lot of dwellings, right? But it's a lot of dwellings per unit of land. What we care about is the number per period of time being added to make sure it's sufficient if we are concerned about supply.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Final pushback for you, Ian. I'm conscious we haven't spoken much about the United States in this conversation, but I was wondering what you made of the study by Albert Sayers from a few years back where he used satellite data to construct estimates of the amount of available land around major US cities. And essentially, he found that cities that were constrained by, bodies of water or steep slopes that meant that they couldn't spread out very much had systematically higher house prices. What do you make of that and how does it jibe with your theories?
I mean, I can't recall that one in any great detail. I mean, there's a lot of studies that try and do similar kinds of things and, there's a few things to say about it, right? One is that at the very most basic level, yes, obviously, no one's denying that there's a relationship between supply of houses and prices, as we said. So that's the first thing.
Yeah.
The problem is they get the sort of magnitude, the order of magnitude wrong. but the second thing is there's lots of fancy econometrics that's done with all sorts of confounding variables and all sorts of omitted variables. Basically, they're saying, trust me, I'm a magic econometrician. I've done this model. It's great. It's perfect. And I'm like, look, let's use some basic Econ 101 theory, the accepted theory of house pricing in the literature. Let's just use that theory. And then let's look at some basic data. let's not overcomplicate this. There's no need to get into the, you know, I'm a magician stuff. We just need to keep it simple. And when you keep it simple, it becomes very hard to explain these things away. I mean, you know, you see it in, I'm not an expert on any US cities, but just, you know, people talk a lot about, you know, what Atlanta and San Francisco and the differences between them. But I mean, if you just take the data on their rents and their median incomes in those cities, you can basically explain what you're seeing there with nothing more fancy than that. I don't say that like that's the entire story, but like to a first approximation, it looks like median incomes in San Francisco have absolutely skyrocketed in real terms in recent decades. So rents have too. So prices have too. And there might be some of the expectations bubble type behavior that Cameron talked about earlier on top. But it's not clear to me that you know, there's a slam dunk story about a supply shortage here, and you know, you can play the same story the other way for places like Atlanta. So you know, I just think we need to, like, you know, to be convincing, supply shortage advocates need to be able to, let's just explain the simple stuff first, and then we can get on to more fancy stuff later. And I think that's the problem, that there's no engagement with the more simple story, and there needs to be.
Yeah. I've read that paper. I've had referee reports come back to me and say, why didn't you cite this paper? It's become infamous. But, you know, they do the same thing. They use house prices. And we know house prices are the capitalized net rents that are affected by interest rates and taxes, and you have this halo effect at the tier one cities and all this other baggage. And you know, I some of the variables they use, I just think, well, I could have selected them to make it anything I want as well. I've been through that paper in detail, but of course in the US they have this whole Harvard Laser school of thought, this whole machinery that supports this story, so it becomes popular. Let me I'm going to quote to you about that in the US, about this sort of...
And of course, when you say Harvard Glazer School of Thought, you're referring to Ed Glazer, the renowned real estate economist at Harvard University.
The renowned real estate economist who writes stuff that people in real estate and planning just rub their heads, you know, they bang their heads together and go, hey, does this guy know anything about real estate? You know, it's madness. So I have a paper critiquing one of his methods. And this will just get to the point about what I mean, that, you know, it's not the validity of the argument. They didn't use rents, they used prices. They missed all these other factors. You know, there's a lot going on. Can they explain the simple stuff? They say, they tell a story that suits their tribe. Let me quote to you a comment I got back from a journal reviewer of a paper I did critiquing Glazer. Glazer and Giorco, who wrote this paper. Glazer and Giorco, I'll quote, have both done a lot of good work. This strand of the literature is an aberration. So the professions prior is that Glazer and Giorco are right and Murray is not. To move that prior, Murray has to be succinct and serious. Succinct because nobody is going to start reading a long paper by someone they think is a kook. And serious because Murray must prove himself part of the brotherhood, not an outsider or rabble-rouser. That's word for word. I've got to join the brotherhood, worship Ed Glazer, and then you will consider that he was full of crap when he wrote that paper. This is the reality of it. It's mad. They're like, yeah, you're totally right. What they did was stupid. It's wrong. Two people have already said it's wrong. Everyone who knows anything thinks it's wrong, but you've got to suck up to him because we've got a club who likes saying this thing and it suits our professional interests. So, you know, I think there's a lot of that in the housing supply story, and I've probably been going on about it too much.
I think there's a lot of that, and that's why it's kind of interesting what the Bank of England's now done. Now they've got two separate bits of work.
Yeah.
They've published two separate research teams that have basically come out and said, you know, yeah. So I've explained the simple stuff without some complicated model. I mean, we've done quite a lot of econometric modeling in previous papers, but I just felt like you don't get any cut through with an econometric model that tries to explain this stuff better, because it's just my magic versus your magic, and who cares? So you need something that's just based on the simple story. But what's interesting is that then the bank has gone and taken that and gone, okay, let's try and model that more formally. And now they're sort of you know, saying this is there's no evidence of a supply shortage having driven this. And it'll be interesting to see whether that shifts the Brotherhood story, because I think, you know, it was until recently completely unanimous among academic economists that this was the explanation, and now it's very far from that. And most public, high-profile public economists in the UK are starting to say, you know, it's not that; it is an interest rate story. So it may change.
I can only hope we're just a few years behind you, because our central bank is doubling down on their Brotherhood worshipping and replicating more of Glaser's failed methods, and doubling down on the supply story. So I got my fingers crossed there. Maybe when we can travel again, I'll take a tour to the Bank of England and share some ideas.
Yes. And what's also interesting is that David Miles, who's one of the former Monetary Policy Committee members who wrote the latest paper, you know, certainly in the past, I think he's been on record as saying, you know, it's a supply issue and things like that. So, yeah, he's shown a lot of kind of flexibility in trying to, you know, look at this afresh and that kind of thing. And it's quite encouraging, really, because I think I've been involved in a few discussions with him, and he's always been pretty open-minded and you know, quite flexible about it. But so many other people just not exhibiting any kind of you know, willingness to look at things again.
Do you think, Ian, there's a series of reports, what do you call them in the UK, a couple of famous ones looking into housing supply? We call them like Lewin report, and another one. Do you think they had much of an effect on I guess looking more deeply and unpicking the story, or do you think they mostly reinforced it, the supply myth story?
You think there are some that said that articulated the supply myth?
I'm asking whether you think I'm asking whether there was the Lewin report. I know there was about three of them in the late, what do we call the noughties? The late noughties and early teens. And they all looked at this housing absorption rate and whether there's sufficient housing supply. Okay. And I noticed that those reports were a lot more open-minded than many of the ones I've seen here from our Productivity Commission in 2011, Reserve Bank and things. Do you think they had much of an effect, or do you think it was really the Bank of England got lucky with a few researchers who were just sticklers for the evidence and went out?
So yeah, the Letwin review two years ago. It was quite recent, but it was basically trying to get at the point that you articulated, that why is the build out rate so slow? They kind of accepted that basically the largely unspoken premise of that is, like, it's not really about how many permissions we're issuing. There's plenty of them.
Yeah.
The problem is they're not building out fast enough. Why is that? And broadly, you know, not in quite the same terms, but it basically says what you're saying, that, you know, they're worried about, they don't want to have a fire sale. There's an absorption rate they can handle. And it doesn't go into the stuff which I think is much more behind it, which is the sort of stuff you've written about you know, managing hedging and managing risk over the long term and all that stuff. But it's basically a tacit admission, I think, that really is not going to do the job.
Well, that's my impression. You know, you have to read between the lines of these things. And for someone who wasn't there to be in the policy debate, it felt to me like it was a bit of a tacit admission. But then often I've seen tacit admissions get talked up as, you know, the previous myth through the media. So, you know, hopefully we'll have some of those key moments that shift our thinking here. Look, I think after this coronavirus crisis, the Airbnb, the volatility that's going to come, there's going to be a lot of scope for rethinking and having real frank, hard look at things and dropping all those sort of deeply held stories and myths. So, yeah, I've got my fingers crossed.
We live in hope.
Yeah.
Final question, because I'm conscious of time, and I know you're in the middle of your work day there, Ian, especially. But essentially, we've been backward looking in this conversation so far and thinking about what has caused and what can explain house prices in Australia and the UK. I want to talk about forecasts finally. And the Australian housing market has been very fertile ground for lots of headline grabbing forecasts over the years, especially around claims that it's a bubble. I myself was very bearish on Australian house prices beginning in 2017 and was still very bearish in 2019 until APRA, that's Australia's macroprudential regulator, and until they backflipped and removed the minimum serviceability buffer. But, you know, more broadly, the Australian housing market is sort of regarded in hedge fund circles as the widowmaker, has been for many years, because a lot of macro funds have betted against it for so long, but it never seems to deliver the crash that all the housing bears are eagerly awaiting. I remember a report that Jonathan Tepper and John Hempton famously produced, or, well, it was Tepper's report, I should say, in 2016. It was titled, "I Know a Guy Who Can Get Things Done," and it was based on a trip they did around Western Sydney where they were investigating loan underwriting standards. Hempton actually came on my podcast last year. John's a hedge fund manager, and told the story of how they went undercover to these banks and mortgage brokers posing as a gay couple to see how disproportionate a loan they could borrow. And I was always struck reading that report that Tepper produced. There was a lot of like reasoning by analogy. And, you know, these are some of the valuations we've seen in previous housing markets that ended in crashes. And, you know, this is the story in Ireland, in Spain, in the United States, or going back further, this is what happened in Japan or in the Scandinavian countries in the late 80s, early 90s. Looking across many of the famous housing bubbles of history, and then using almost like, I guess, a base rate approach, or what Danny Kahneman would call like a category view or an outside view, to form the basis for a forecast on the Australian housing market. And I always wondered whether, given the non-stationarity of these time series, like so many of the parameters have changed over the decades. We've spoken about many of those changes, interest rates, or, you know, just the size of households, or population growth, or even just narratives more broadly. In recent months, I've kind of had serious reservations about like the base rate approach for thinking about where house prices will go. And I guess, to cut a long story short, my question for both of you is, what classifies, in your opinion, as an appropriate forecast when it comes to a housing market? Like, what is something that is intellectually defensible when it comes to a prediction about house prices?
That's a question. Now, I'm not sure whether this is exactly answering it, but I guess the first point is that almost all house price forecasts are not intellectually defensible. I don't expect to screw that. And I guess, to the extent, you know, I suppose there's two things you can do. To get a headline, if you're some sort of estate agent or whatever, you can do some kind of momentum-based guesswork. Mm. And maybe that's not a bad thing to do, right? You just say, well, last year they went up 5%, so this year we think they'll go up 5% again. Great. So the only thing that it's in any way really possible to do is to have some kind of medium-term forecast. You can probably do that with some value, but I think the value only comes from spelling out the channels and your view on them. So I would never bother to make a forecast of what UK house prices are going to be in 5 years' time. I've been wrong so many times before that I'm not going to be right now. But I can say that, you know, like if you think about the major drivers, well, what are the major drivers? There's houses and household numbers. Well, that's hardly going to change, right? It's going to tick along. Maybe the surplus will grow a bit, tiny downward pressure on prices. Incomes, that's the big unknown at the moment, mm-hmm. but there could be quite a big shock, certainly in short term to incomes. That could take a chunk out of house prices in a short period. Interest rates, well, it looks like they're staying low for a very long time now. So that's the biggest driver. And I don't really see, I mean, you can certainly tell stories where you get some inflation spike because of a supply side shock and all the rest of it. So we could be in that, in a world where interest rates start to rise, but you need to be convincing on that story before you said that prices were going to fall a lot because of that. And then there's regulations. How much is that going to change? Who knows? And then there's narratives. And I think you can imagine, some of these narrative stories, particularly around cities like London, might be punctured, particularly given the nature of coronavirus and its population proximity. And it could really turn the narrative into reverse. So I think you've kind of put those things together and you kind of get a sense of the balance of risks coming through each of those channels. And then everyone can form their own view on them. I don't think it's worth putting a number on. Mm. So I guess a roundabout way of saying it, I suppose, is what's an intellectually defensible forecast is probably one that doesn't involve a number, but it just involves a bit of reasoning. So sorry about that.
Yeah, great. No, that makes total sense. And Cam?
Look, the defensible one is I have no idea. But I guess I just agree with Ian there. You got to get the orders of magnitude right on what these drivers of prices are. A lot of people go, "Well, we're going to keep having population growth, so that's going to support prices." I'm like, "Well, yeah, I guess it sort of does in a way because of buying, but you know, we're building enough houses. Maybe it only works through the story exactly, of population growth in Sydney and Melbourne. So maybe the mechanism is not that there's a lot of people and not enough houses. It's actually like, we believe that it's wrong, but because we believe it, we're willing to pay a higher price.
I've always thought
and
that.
I think, just getting the orders of magnitude of the effects right. I think I agree that the low interest rates forever are is the reasonable forecast. I always call the monetary policy is a ratchet, and it works by expanding the debts and making it more difficult to raise interest rates the next time. And then you lower them and you expand it and it makes it more difficult. I think looking to countries like Japan, who've had a big demographic shift that's coming, I think it's worth having in the back of your mind that a lot of the richest homeowners are going to die in the next 20 years and that the attitudes and, you know, stability of work and all the rest of the potential buying pool might be different. So apart from these short-term or short to medium-term, interest rates, regulations, taxation of home ownership, whatever the case is, I think it's worth having in the back of your mind that in 20 years, there's going to be a lot of forced turnover of housing from a large pool of homeowners to a small pool of potential buyers. And that's the thing that I keep in the back of my mind. And I think it's, if you're looking out past 10 years, you should think about that.
Mm. And I guess in Tokyo, for example, you've also got the impact of that fact of changing demographics on the narrative combined with the searing experience of whatever, 89, 90, probably conspired to make a very powerful narrative, I suspect, that it's basically impossible to model. So forget about it.
I remember speaking with somebody in finance about how the narrative changed in Tokyo, where, you had the bubble years where property was a fantastic investment, you know, obviously, and everyone was buying it. And then more recently, you could get brilliant yields in Tokyo, and you ask people why they're not investing, and they say, well, prices always go down. Why would I invest?
Right. Yeah.
Look, and I don't look. Well, we should maybe come back to this in 20 years, but that could be like the norm in a lot of the current developed, rich, old places. This, you know, we'll be looking back and laughing on New York. It's where they used to think prices only went up. How silly were they?
Yeah.
It might happen. I think you just, you know, just be prepared that there's that, you know, these are large tsunamis of change that are inevitable, and that they're coming. So, you know, the average home ownership of people over 60 is something like 82%. You can correct me if I'm wrong. It's much, much higher than the potential buyers under 40.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
And that group also owns multiple more investment houses. We'll see. Either the wealth will concentrate through or spread through their families, and that, or they'll have to be passed around.
We'll have to check back in a few decades then. But until then, Cam Murray, Ian Mulhern, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. For links and show notes for everything we discussed, you will find those on my website, josephnoelwalker.com. That's my full name, josephnoelwalker.com. I also want to draw your attention to our Facebook discussion forum, where listeners of the podcast get together to talk about episodes, links, and related readings and sources. It's a really cool way to go into more topic on the podcast episodes with people who have listened to them as well. That discussion forum is called Swagman and Swagettes. The and is an ampersand because we like to do things a little bit differently at the Jolly Swagman podcast. So if you go to Facebook and enter Swagman and Swagettes, join the group. Once you're admitted, you'll be able to discuss episodes with like-minded people. It's a great community. Thank you so much for your time and for listening. Until next time, ciao.